On today's Bill of the Flatter Show, episode 89, an amateur playwriter, smog, 70s porn, a 5-octave vocal range, and a whale. All of this and more! The Flatter Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Tab for my diet. Tab, you know what I just noticed in Tab? There's a hint of lemon in the Tab. I don't know if that's just my taste buds or it's my imagination or if it actually is in there, but I had this hint of lemon. And you all know that lemon goes with diet colas. That's traditional. Old-fashioned 70s way of doing things. To get rid of the bitterness of saccharine, use a little bit of lemon in your diet cola. Welcome to the Flatus Show. I'm Kenty. You can reach me at 206-984-3617. Leave your voice comments. You can put this number on your cell phone, and it'll make it easier for you to communicate with me. And you can also, if you want to use I was going to say snail mail, but it's not really snail mail. If you want to reach me by email, flatusshow@gmail.com. Come to my website at theflatusshow.com, and you'll find all that information there, how to reach me. And you'll find the show notes, the podcast, and a bunch of other crap. Or stuff. I should say, there is an Amazon.com store. So if you're in the market to buy something, come to thy Amazon.com store and buy it through there, because that will help support the Flatus Show. You know, NPR does that and helps support NPR, but NPR has a greater fan base, I guess, than the Flatus Show. Anyway, welcome to the Flatus. It's a wonderful spring day in Cape Ann. I have a new workout program I'm going to be doing. And I talked to a guy Saturday at the gym, Paul. And so I'm going to start adding barbells to the dumbbells I'm doing and alternate my chest and shoulders and et cetera for my legs and other things. I have it all written down. See how specific I am? It's like there's certain muscle groups that you use pull techniques with, and the other ones are push techniques. So you have the pull techniques together and the push and pull techniques together each, and do those on separate days. Also work the largest muscle group first. That's what I learned. So I'm going to start that. I started with the barbells on Saturday, and it really made a big difference. I really feel like I've made an improvement on my chest. You know, I feel like I'm actually working something more than the dumbbells I was working with. So pretty soon I'll be all sexy. I'll have a ripped body, and I'll take photographs of myself and become narcissistic. You can all drool over my body. Or maybe Jose will drool over my body. He's out with Johnny right now. He's on a run to the supermarket. But I want to, in this beginning, there's a lot of stuff going on in the show today. A lot of information, a lot of things I've been talking about and interested in. Trying to tie it all together. Anyway, but the big thing is really important that you listen to this now before you listen to anything. And I need you to come to theflatusshow.com, click on the show notes, and then click on the please donate to the Easter Seals. Anything will do. And as I said, if all of my listeners donate, I can have quite, can collect quite a bit. I'm doing the walk. And, I want you to donate to the Easter Seals. You know, it's important. Those kids really deserve it. It's adults, you know. It's a good organization. They're fiscally responsible, and they really do make a difference in communities throughout the United States. I'm not sure where they're located outside of the United States, but please donate to the Easter Seals and help me raise my goal. I have to make at least $150. And I know I have enough listeners out there that if you donate, then it will make much more than $150. And I think that's important that my listeners, you know, take some responsibility. Yes, this is all fun. I do this for fun. I pay for this. Fine. I don't really ask you to do anything. I'm not asking you for money. I don't have advertising, even though you might think I do with Tab, my diet, but I really don't. I'm not paid. I'm not, you know, like other podcasters who are paid, the few podcasters that are paid. I'm like the most of the podcasters, which are like, you know, actually lose money doing this. But I do know that there are quite a bit of listeners all over the place, all over the world, even in Afghanistan. Can you believe that? And so I need you to nut up, so to speak, and open your wallets and donate some cash to the Flatish Show, to the Easter Seals. See, you got me all flustered because, you know, you're not doing it. So it's very important that you do this. $10 even, you know, that'd be a big help to the Easter Seals. That would be no time we'll have the $150. It'd probably go up maybe even to $1,000 if each of you do that. It would make a big difference. Now, I know probably, you know, like NPR, they already know a certain percentage aren't going to do it. But you know what? I'm not NPR. As a limited number of people, I could probably come and see each of you. Well, maybe not a week or two because I'd have to fly all over the place. But, you know, the thing is that it's conceivable that you listeners, we could all meet in a big room somewhere, you know, where NPR, you really couldn't do that in a big room because there's too many people. But, you know, it's important, you know, that you, you know, do something. And I don't ask you for much, but I am asking you to come and donate to the Easter Seals because it is very important. I don't ask you for any money. It's free. You seem to enjoy what I talk about. I enjoy what I talk about. Some shows are better than others, but that's the truth with everything. So, you know, if you want to help, it's not even supporting the – you're really not supporting the Flatish Show by donating the Easter Seals, but you're making a – you're telling me that you care, that you really care about the Flatish Show and that you want to see it continue. Because, you know, I have to make a difference somehow. And so if it means raising money for Easter Seals, then that will be a reason to do the Flatish Show. But, I mean, if you know, that's a good, noble reason, you know. I mean, I do it for myself as well, okay. But I really want to do something to help other people. I just don't want to, you know, jerk off all day doing the Flatish Show for you guys. So please come to the website and donate, okay. I'm tired. There's zero for this past week. So I need you to do that. And if you have a podcast or if you have a means of spreading the word out to your big audience or whatever, then tell them to go to the East. Okay, if you don't want to mention the Flatish Show, just tell them to go to Easter Seals and donate, okay? Christ. Okay. So anyway, not to say Christ. Something else. Urinary diversion. So anyway, on that note, I expect to see some donations on that Easter Seals page by the end of next week. Or you know what? Maybe I'll just stop doing the podcast because, you know what? Fuck you. You have to help me out. So, and this is not to say fuck you to people who have already donated in the past because I know you. I'm talking about the other 90% or more. So, you know, get your ass moving and do something, okay? Stop jerking off.
There will be a sweet taste in the air from industrial waste in the air, and your eyelids will smart from the sting of the smog in the spring of next year. There will be a black slick on the sand, and the sludge will be thick on the sand, and your eardrums will thrill to the ring of the the spring of next year. All the apple trees blooming as they're crushed into pulp. There'll be smokestacks consuming each available gulp that's inhalable. But the moment most thrilling begins when the pneumatic drilling begins. It's a song that all Paris will sing in the bountiful spring of next year. There will be a sweet taste in the air from industrial waste in the air, and your eyelids will smart from the sting of the smog in the spring of next year. There will be a black slick on the sand, and the sludge will be thick on the sand, and your eardrums will thrill to the ring of the axe in the spring of next year. All the apple trees blooming as they're crushed into pulp. There'll be smokestacks consuming each available gulp that's inhalable. You'll be watching the statues corrode. We'll be hearing the fountains explode. It's a song that all Paris will sing in the bountiful spring of next year.
The plays of Cho Seung-hui. Well, I wasn't going to talk about the Virginia Tech Massacre, and I'm not really going to talk about the Virginia Tech Massacre, but there was a Virginia Tech Massacre. And the killer, and I hate to use that word, because, I mean, yes, he killed, but I don't like the word killer because it puts a brand on somebody as the only thing they are, where the fact of the matter is, it's easier to put a killer to death, but it's harder to put a human to death. And to say the word killer dehumanizes, and that's not to say that killing dehumanizes. I mean, senseless killing dehumanizes, which is, in this case, is certainly true. Cho Seung-hui went on a senseless killing spree, trying to, apparently, from what I've read, trying to right the wrongs that were done to him. So there are these plays that he wrote in his creative writing class, and I found the copies of them on AOL. It was AOL homepage, some blog. I'll have the links so you can read them yourself. But they're very short. They're each about 11 pages, 10, 11 pages. Interestingly, both are, the titles are after men's names. One's, the first one, Richard McBeef, and the second one, Mr. Brownstone. And it's very interesting, you know, the way that this blogger who, I guess he was in the creative writing class with Cho, and, or Seung-hui, maybe, because I think Cho is the last name, Seung-hui, he was in the writing class, but it's so bloviated the way he talks about this blog. He goes, when I first heard about the Virginia Tech killings and then they said he was Asian, I thought of Cho Sang-hui because it was so disturbing, these plays that he wrote. They're so violent and so from a madman, from the mind of a madman, and they're discoherent and stuff like that. And, you know, and everybody's been saying that about these plays of his and his writing. Now, I've read them, and they are not the they're not the most natural sounding plays, okay? But let's face it. I mean, you know, he was I don't even know what he was. Probably a tech guy, some sort of techie, and probably writing was not his strong point, considering his background, because he was raised in this Korean family who apparently the parents spoke no English, and you know, he was this only child, right? So he was living two worlds. He was living the Korean world at home, right, and then he was living the American world on the outside. Interesting, I had the opportunity to talk to I don't know if she was Korean or Chinese, an Asian girl, and we worked together for a short period of time, several years ago, and she told me that it was difficult for her because her parents she was the only child, her parents did not speak English. So she had to, from the age of like 8 or 9, be the translator for her parents between doctors, between, you know, the retail, like the lease, like leasing apartments, all of these responsibilities, which normally children don't have to do. I mean, children should be taking care of the parents. They shouldn't be responsible for stuff like that. So I'm sure Cho Sang-hui had the same similar experiences, which is unfortunate, you know, put a lot of pressure on him. Now, as for his two plays, Richard McBeef and Mr. Brownstone, I think they have been unfairly reviewed, and I don't think... there is violence in them, but I don't think they're all about violence or killing, actually. Richard McBeef, we'll start with that one. It's... Please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals! We start off, we have a family. We have a father and a mother and a son. The father, Richard McBeef, is the stepfather, actually, of the son. And apparently, it's Richard McBeef, his wife, Sue, and their son, John. Sue is John's natural mother. His father, John's father, had died 1 month previous to this, and Richard McBeef is the stepfather. So what we have, it starts off with the stepfather trying to get to know the son, the stepson. And the son keeps saying, you're not my father, you're just my stepfather. And he's being sassy. And the father puts his arm on the kid and he says, you're molesting me, you're a pedophile. At this point, the mother comes in and says to the stepfather, oh, why are you doing this? You're supposed to be talking to my son and, you know, not doing this. And then the son... The John keeps on saying, he's a pedophile. And the mother goes ballistic. And she throws a plate at the stepfather. And it's interesting that the stepfather just stands there. The plate breaks and the stepfather comes after because he's walking towards the mother. The mother keeps on screaming, you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me. So she keeps on throwing things at him. At one point, she goes into the basement and picks up a chainsaw. Now, it is the mother, really, who has all this violence. I mean, she's the one with throwing the dishes, accusing the father of pedophilia, and so she sends the boy upstairs, John. If it sounds disconnected, it's because it is kind of disconnected, the play. And I don't have the script right in front of me, okay? So,
the mother convinces, the son convinces the mother that the stepdad is a pedophile. And she goes ballistic. Okay, so he goes up, the son goes up into his room. And the mother continues her assault with the machine, not machine gun, what was it? You cut down trees with them. Chainsaw. Finally, the father goes into the garage and sits in the car. And the mother's wherever. She's in the basement, okay? At this point, John, the son, the 13-year-old son, comes down and gets into the car. And starts being sassy with him again. I mean, I'd have to read it. I could print it out and read it, but I'm not going to. You can do it. But he's just being sassy. And the father's had enough, and then he smacks the kid. Now, it says he smacks the kid with a deathly blow, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was that he killed the son. You know, it could have been just he hit the son. I mean, you know, there's violence in there. What I find interesting is this, is I think that the stepfather represents an authority, right? And the mother sort of undermines that authority. Listening to the son, the mother listens to the son. The son can lie, and yet the mother will believe the son. And the father has, you know, no control really over the son. I think the boy, John, and probably Cho, Sang-hui Cho, is really looking for direction. And he's really crying out for a mentor. He's crying out for somebody who will give him a sense of right and wrong and how to behave like a man. But here we have a boy who's been coddled by his mother. And you know, finally in this play, how he cries out for the help is that the father just smacks him down. You know, I've had enough of your shit, says the father. And that's probably what Cho Sang-hui really needed. Not a smack in the face, but somebody to just, like, spank him, so to speak, okay? Not necessarily physically, but somebody to say, you know what? You've had it. You've had enough. Don't be a shit. Now, I mean, of course, his personality in this chose Cho. Cho, which is probably his last name since it's Korean. Sang-hui. He was apparently very quiet. He didn't talk. He was a loner. You know, the poor kid, he probably really couldn't relate to many people, you know, because of his experiences and stuff. But he was crying out for help. But it's not the kind of violence that you think. He really needed a mentor. He needed somebody that would give him a solid, strict upbringing. He rebelled too. You know, it's just, he rebelled against his church and stuff. His mother was very strict Christian, and he rebelled against anything strict. At the same time, he wanted that. He needed something, and it was something missing in his life. And I probably, and I'm just, you know, I'm the pop psychologist. I'm gonna write a book about it. Cho Sang-hui. What was I going to say about him? He lived in these two worlds. He lived in the Korean world and the English world. And he probably had a lot of more responsibilities on his shoulders than we do. Now, the second play, Mr. Brownstone, sort of makes me think that he really was kind of abused by teachers in his school. And what I mean by abused is, in my own high school, there were teachers. I've had classes, like a Spanish class. It was a Mr. Reeves, who was a Spanish teacher, who's a big old queer. And he used to make fun of, you know, certain people, you know, in the class. And, you know, he was disrespectful and praised others. And, you know, it's very possible that, you know, Cho Sang-hui had this kind of, had these kind of teachers. They still are out there. I mean, just, you know, just because it's 2007 doesn't mean anything, really. So Mr. Brownstone... Oh, hold on. Let me go get my tea.
Hold on.
I'm back. Okay. Mr. Brownstone is a play. It has three young people, teenagers, who end up going to a casino. Getting into the casino. It's actually two guys and a girl. And, they get into the casino using phony IDs, and they, while they're there, they're saying, I'm so glad we can hang out here, because we can't hang out in front of the grocery store, we can't hang out in the corner, we can't hang out anywhere. I'm so glad we can get in here. So they're, you know, playing their casino, the stuff, the slots. Please go to theflatishow.com. Click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals! Voot, voot, voot! The conversation soon turns to Mr. Brownstone, their authoritarian math teacher, and how much they hate him. And they want to kill him, and he's just an old fart. He's just terrible. At this point, it's just kids being anarchic, really. I mean, it's like, you know, I don't think... He was really meaning to... He was being violent. It's just, you know... I think it was just a crude way of writing. His writing is very crude, okay? I mean, it's not David Hwang or David Mamet, even. You know, I mean, clearly it's not. I mean, he's not a writer. You know, he's only 20-something, right? It's a kid, really. Let's face it. 40 is the new 30, so what is 20, the new 10? You know? He's a kid. And so, let's see here. So anyway, these three kids represent anarchy and new things and change, and they're ranting and raving against the authority, which in this case is the Mr. Brownstone. So what happens, the kids... They're saying, yeah, Mr. Brownstone is just like that Guns N' Roses song called Mr. Brownstone, which I don't know, but I guess it's a song called Mr. Brownstone. So the kids start singing Mr. Brownstone, which is about heroin addiction. And, I'm not really sure. Maybe it's a little William Burroughs-esque in the play. So at this point, Mr. Brownstone comes in and says, what are you kids doing here, you know? Jose, what are you doing over there? He's farting around on the couch, trying to nesting in the sissy fudge packer's hair. No. So Mr. Brownstone comes in. He's 45, by the way, but he's the old man. And he says, what are you kids doing here? You know, you're... Whatever. He's the authoritarian figure. So the kids, apparently one of the kids, and he wins the lottery, right, or whatever. He wins the slot machine, all this money. At this point, Mr. Brownstone goes away and brings back a security guard from the casino and says, and acts like an old man. He says, these kids, these young whippersnappers just stole my tickets, my money. And so the casino people take the ticket from the kid who actually did win it and give it to Mr. Brownstone, who at the end smiles, and the kids are thrown out. So, you know, I think what he's up against, you know, he's probably feeling that whatever he does, even if he wins, it's going to be taken by the man. It's going to be taken by the authority, you know. So he has this distrust for authority. At the same time, he needs authority, as in the first play. He needs that. He needs to have a mentor. He needs to have rules. This is a boy who has no rules, and that's a sad fact. And he has no boundaries. And finally, you know, feeling persecuted, and I'm not going to say unrightfully so, but certainly his response to these feelings was wrong, okay? You just don't do that. There's no boundaries in his life. It just broke through, and... What do they say about these killers? They get to a certain point and it's like, well, you know what? There's no way back from here. Once you've shot the first person, there's just no going back. And
So I feel bad for Cho Sang-hui, and I feel, you know, I feel terrible about the lives that were lost, who really didn't, you know, probably didn't do anything. I mean, we don't know what, maybe these, I shouldn't say that. I mean, it sounds callous, but we really don't know how these people he killed treated Cho Sang-hui either. And it's not to justify what he did, but, you know, it's like, you know, you play with matches, you know, you're going to set a fire, right? So, I mean, you have to be careful how you treat people, you know? You just can't, you know, if you're the kind of person who teases people, you know, sometimes you tease people long enough, they're going to come back and, you know, smack you in the head. Of course, Cho Sang-hui did it in a really, you know, terrible way, and then something that's wrong. Again, I said he had no boundaries, so. So, that's my thoughts about this whole matter. It's a terrible tragedy. But what I have to say is just be aware of what you do and how you treat people and how you interpret people. And just don't write everybody off. People are humans. And people are humans. That's stupid. Of course we're human, you know. But what I should say is don't pigeonhole people, even people who are who do killings, who are killers. I hate the noun killers.
The world is full of a number of things, and one of them is people.
But people is the escape that people escape from most.
They take to gin and to histamine, to aspirin, Picasso and television.
And some take Consolidated Gas.
Or the Saturday Evening Post.
Pity you, we do, for all the ills that ail you. But here's good news for you, you needn't be a failure.
A failure.
Tiddly-i, tiddly-ay, tiddly all your trouble away. You, too, can be a puppet.
You, too, can be a puppet.
Please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals. Voot, voot, voot.
Ollie.
Tiddly-i, tiddly-dee, you can be just as happy as we. Be a puppet, not an also red.
Come out of the woodwork, brother.
And join the brotherhood of man.
The brotherhood of man.
So begins the musical Flahoolie. Before there was Avenue Q, there was Flahoolie. Flahoolie, the musical with puppets. It also included Ema Sumac, Barbara Cook, and that's it. Isn't that enough to make it a little-known musical? It's surprisingly that it was even recorded. It's a very strange little musical, but I thought it was really interesting. The little bit, I just wanted to let everybody know. I didn't realize this, but the book for this musical is by E.Y. Harburg and Fred Sadie. Lyrics by Harburg and music by Sammy Fain. So, actually, it has some, you know, Broadway gravitas behind it. Now, this is from Wikipedia, wikipedia.org, for all your information needs. The allegorical tale is set in fictional Capsulanta, USA, site of the headquarters for B.G. Bigelow, Incorporated, the largest toy corporation in the world. Puppet designer Sylvester has created laughing doll Flahoolie and is about to unveil it as the company's big Christmas release to the board of directors when the meeting is interrupted by a Saudi Arabian delegation. Their country has run out of oil. The magic lamp upon which they rely is broken, and they hope someone can repair it. So genie Abu Ben Atam, who keeps things running smoothly, will reappear and help them in their time of need. Bigelow, enamored with Princess Najla, agrees and assigns Sylvester to the project. He succeeds, and hoping to become wealthy enough to marry his model, Sandy, asks for assistance from the genie, who, unclear on the concept of capitalism, begins giving away thousands of dolls. Before long, a witch is pursuing him in an effort to put an end to his misguided generosity. Harburg successfully had blended politics with fantasy in Finian's Rainbow 4 years earlier, but his bitterness at his 1950 Hollywood blacklisting, which prompted him to write Flahooly, permeated the project. During its evolution, he conceded to some adjustments. Originally, the doll, instead of laughing, yelled, "Dirty Red!" when turned upside down. But his convoluted plot still included too many thinly veiled references to Joseph McCarthy and his followers, and his harsh parody of the ongoing rabid anti-communist sentiment that prompted so many witch hunts has not softened by the inclusion of a genie and singing puppets. It did not help that associate producer, director Harburg, saw no need to edit writer Harburg's overstated political views. The Broadway production, directed by Harburg and Saidi, and choreographed by Helen Tamaris, opened on May 14th of 1951 at the Broadhurst Theater, where it ran for 40 performances. The cast included Jerome Cortland as Sylvester, Ernest Truex as Bigelow, Barbara Cook in her Broadway debut as Sandy, Irwin Corey as Abu Ben Atam, and Ema Sumac as Princess Najla, with Louis Nye, Nehemiah Persoff, and Ted Thurston in supporting roles. Woot, woot, woot. Please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals. Woot, woot, woot. Bill Baird and his wife Cora played small roles in addition to controlling the marionettes that performed You Too Can Be a Puppet, which we just heard, part of it. The opening number that took a swipe at McCarthy's minions and set the tone for the rest of the evening. The original cast recording was released by Capitol Records. Can you believe that it was even made? I mean, the more I read that, the more insane it sounds. I wish I had been able to see it, but of course that was several years before I was born, 13 years before I was born. But Flahooly, what's really bizarre about this is in the one part of the cast recording, you can hear the Flahooly doll laugh. But it's even more evil than that. So if you're interested in B musicals, or in this case, like a double D musical or a Z musical, pick up Flahooly. It has been re-released on Capitol Records CDs. I'm not sure if it's available anymore, but it's worth a look. And you know what's also odd about this musical is the vocal stylings of Ema Sumac. If you know anything about Ema Sumac, she's the Peruvian princess with a 4-octave range or 5.5-octave range, and she sings all these exotic things. I have her albums. I love Ema Sumac. I just find it so bizarre that they got all these people together to do this. You know Ema Sumac, right? They say Ema Sumac, well, her claim was that she's a Peruvian princess, la-di-la-di yada. However, The going theory is that she is Amy Camus from Brooklyn, which is Ema Sumac spelled backwards. So who knows whether she's Amy Camus from Brooklyn or whether she's Ema Sumac, Peruvian princess from Peru or somewhere down south in the South American continent. So is Peru in South America or is that Central America? Okay. Well, you can figure that one out. But just remember, before there was Avenue Q, we had Flahooly.
Roundabouts are coming. Jaguar Productions, in association with Dick Martin, proudly introduces you to a group when sex is only an experimental urge, who later grow up to be the most handsome, most seductive, sexually stunning males alive. Meet the Roundabouts. Glenn the Swinger. Mark the Pretty Boy. Roy the Cruiser, and Daryl, the one who wants them all. A spectacular vision of homosexuality comes alive on the motion picture screen, with a daring display of originality and the hard sting of realism. Its eye-catching settings, unique sex, and whirlwind pacing guarantees it a memorable spot among the classic erotic male films.
What's new in the free world? Oh, nothing much. Just waiting for you to get clean.
Do you love me very much?
Yes, I do. You know it.
The roundabouts play for real. There's not a boy alive they can't take on, put down, or keep going on a mind-blowing trip. Announcing that a forgotten sexual pact to be fulfilled, no matter what the circumstances, will be kept.
You're charming, really, but you know my setting.
You guys never trick out?
You little devil. Well, it's happened just superficially, but we're really very much in love.
But things go completely wild before the pact is completed, and the roundabout action starts when all of the guys meet at the wrong times in the right places. And this creates a sexual quadrangle that will have you spinning and glowing.
Please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals. Voot, voot, voot.
And I really love him.
There is a warm, beautifully acted, unpretentious film photographed by Barry Knight with tender loving care. All of the thrilling encounters and spontaneous emotional moments will work their way into your hearts until you've fallen completely in love with these wonderful guys. This quality don't come along often enough. Technically, it surpasses all the others. Everyone involved can take a bow for the roundabouts. Starring Mark Richards, Glenn Brock, Daryl Hughes, and Roy Clark. Directed by Dick Martin, today's most inventive male filmmaker. Dick Martin. Breathtaking masterpiece will create a moving place in your memory when you keep that special date with The Roundabouts. Come in.
Well, kids, how'd you like that? 1970s porn. Nothing is as sexy as 1970s gay porn, let me tell you. Where's my pen? That's not sexy. My pen. Say that. Well, this is a urinary tract diversion. Urinary diversion. Okay. Hold on. Let me get my tea. So, yeah. 1970s porn. I found that online. I just love the audio. I think it's hilarious. You know, it sounds like they really did, put a lot into it. I mean, that was a coming attractions. In the movie theaters, right, at the end of the video, you actually have this drawing of saying, coming soon to this theater, and has a picture of the, that's on the screen. There's people in the seats watching the movie. But it's not just like sex people, you know, these horny old men. It's women and men. They're smiling, looking at the screen. So, you know, it's a tender, loving, it's a tender story about young men growing up. young 21-year-olds. Hustlers. But he's my lover. I love him. So this little section also about sex. What am I doing? Well, it all has to do with sex and sexuality and, you know, feeling it and letting yourself be sexual, okay? I think far too long, especially with gay podcasters, gay podcasting, including my show, if we've cut the balls off of gay, you know? Gay doesn't mean anything. Let's face it. The only thing gay about being gay is that men love men. And, you know, that means, you know, penises and balls and chest and hair and all that. Nothing says chest hair like and balls and dick like as 1970s porn, so I use that as the opening. I don't know about straight porn from the 70s, but certainly gay porn was much better. One of my favorite directors is Joe Gage. He did a trilogy, Kansas City Trucking Company, El Paso Wrecking Something, and L.A. Tool and Die. And, they're just terrific. And one of the actors in those movies, the porn actors, and he's my favorite porn actor. One of my, well, I shouldn't say one of, because it makes me sound like I have a lot of favorite porn actors. And it's not like I've watched a lot of porn either. But when I first moved to Boston in 1992, I went to Glad Day Bookstore. It was on Boylston Street across from the Boston Public Library. No longer there. And because I, you know, moved here, I was by myself, and I never really watched any kind of gay porn. So I really went to the bookstore just to look for books, but they have a video section. So I go over to the video section. They have these $9, $10 videos. L.A. Tool and Die. Those three Joe Gage movies. Plus there's one called Closed Set. I bought them. Man, it was like the first time I knew what gay sex really was. I mean, I had only up to that point really, I knew my attractions and everything, right? But it's like when you see two men really, you know, loving each other in a sexual way, it's like, especially in these movies, it's really just like sensuous and real. It's not like gay porn of the 80s, which can be a little bit robotic, you know? And especially the 90s, like very few gay porn movies made recently do anything for me because they're so robotic. And they all focus on twinks. You know, a twink is, you know, like a 24-year-old twink. You know, a twink. I don't know. I'm not really. I think twinks are like, I don't know. I don't even know what a twink is, to tell you the truth. So anyway, yeah, the twinks. So getting back to gay porn of the 70s is a Joe Gage. Anyway, one of my favorite actors is Jack Wrangler. Man, he exudes sexuality. He just exudes it, okay? You know, if you're gay and really don't know what gay is, and you really want to know what gay is, take a gay course. Watch the Joe Gage movies. Watch Jack Wrangler films. And it's interesting, Jack Wrangler, right? Do I have a little... Jose, do I have a clip on Jack Wrangler? No? Let's see here. What do I do here? I printed this out and I don't have the Jack Wrangler. Where's Jack Wrangler? Jose, why didn't you get this ready for me? So anyway, Jack Wrangler, he got out of the, I guess, I don't know when he got out of the porn business, but he's married to Margaret Whiting, okay? Margaret Whiting is a singer from, I think, the 40s or 50s. She's older than he. And they got married. And they're a couple. They're in New York. And that's just really fabulous. Now, Jack Wrangler, you think, why did he marry a woman? He did both gay and straight porn, and who knows why Margaret Whiting married him. I would have married Jack Wrangler. He's handsome. I don't know what he looks like now. I'm sure he still is. He was just like the kind of guy you just could hang out with and fuck. To be quite crude. And I'm not being crude. I'm just being honest, okay? He's just Jack Wrangler. You know, you're mesmerized by Jack Wrangler. He's handsome. And, oh, it's really good. So, where's this leading me? Where else can we talk about sexuality? Well, first of all, as I said about Cho Sang-hui or whatever, he needed to get laid. He needed to get laid, so he didn't have to use all his energy on these insane plot he had. So if he had watched 1970s porn, please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals. And had a friend that he could, do it with. That's assuming he was gay, right? Which apparently that's a theory that Cho Sang-hui was gay, but I don't think he was. I don't know. He just needed to get laid, whether it was with a guy or a girl. He needed to just chill out. Get that, ass loosened up and just take it, not take life so seriously. But we don't really know about his life, so he just did a terrible thing. Okay, so this brings me to gay music, okay? How did I find this? Okay, first off, Mandrake Society Radio, I guess this is where it started, had this, he interviewed this guy, Big Noog, okay? And is a gay hip-hop artist. And it's really good. It's really gay music. I mean, he talks about real things. It's real good gay hip-hop music. It's not like Anna Judy and the Garland I love. It's just a dude. When she sings Over the Rainbow or whatever. You see, I can't rap. I mean, I just don't have it in me, okay? Maybe if I wrote it out, but I can't do it, off the top of my head. But I can sing Broadway show tunes off the top of my head, as you know. I can just make those up. But I can't make up. I can't do with a hip-hop. Hip-hop. So, anyhow. So, he's really good. I want to get his song, his album. It's going to come out in iTunes in a few weeks. And go listen to JW's Mandrake Society Radio. Go to Mandrake Society Radio and listen to his Big Noog interview. It's excellent. So on MySpace, I have a MySpace page. It's myspace.com/flatusshow. And you can go and see all my friends. I have 46 friends now. I had gotten rid of some friends. Why do I yawn every time I start this? I'm not boring myself. I really am not. I don't know why. Maybe there's some sort of, chemicals or. Jose, what are you doing? Jose! He's in my coat now. Just lie down. I know. He has 50% sight. I'm really wondering what he's looking at when he looks at me. So let's get back to, MySpace. Go to MySpace.com. There is an artist there I want to talk about. His name is Harley Phoenix, but his MySpace page is Hirsute Pursuit. Hirsute means hairy. Okay? And he is delicious. Now, his music is unabashedly, unashamedly gay sex. It's sexual. It is sensuous. It's sexual. Unashamedly so. It's trance music. It's trance dance music, I guess. I don't know what you call it. Trance electronica man sex music. You can go to his MySpace page and listen to some songs. Cock Thoughts and Attaboy and Pappy, and there's another one. Yeah, he has up one there, but he's really terrific. He puts the balls back in gay sex. And so, gay podcasters, if you really, just letting you know, I'm gay. You're gay. Get over yourself. You know, just become sensuous, you know, let yourself body. You know, I have become more and more aware of my body since I've been starting to work out at the YMCA. And more comfortable with my body, too. Using the free weights, it makes you very aware of the muscles you're using. And because you're to do these exercises, you have to use a certain form and strict form. You're really aware of your own body. And which I like, you know, I'm never really body centered. You know, I was always in the head. Now I'm becoming, you know, since working, I'm becoming much more body centered, understanding, you know, being me, you know, being aware of my flesh. And also I wasn't looking forward to using the gang shower, it's called. You know, it's a room with the different shower heads. I really preferred private showers. You know, when I was at Gold's Gym, they had private showers. Because, you know, I'm a private person. I'd always cover myself up. But, you know, with this locker room and everything set up and the gang shower I've used. First of all, whenever I use the shower, no one is in there. I've only once or twice as other people were other people in the shower. And it doesn't really bother me. You know, I thought it would bother me, but it doesn't. And I'm becoming more aware. I'm just, you know, becoming more comfortable being naked, you know, in the shower. I don't have to worry. And in the sauna, too, you know. I just, you know, can walk around naked in the in this gym room without being embarrassed or whatever. I just figure maybe it's because I'm 42. I'm like, who the hell cares? It used to really terrify me. You know, like when I was in elementary school, like junior high and high school, it's like I didn't want to take showers and do all that stuff naked and in front of all the other boys. Maybe because of my own, you know, I knew my sexuality and I was afraid of it. And that's probably what it was. I was afraid of my sexuality. Well, I'm not afraid of my sexuality. And it means I can be naked with whoever. Doesn't mean I'm going to have a boner or whatever. You know, I'm aware of my body. And I know I can control it. I'm not going to be embarrassed by it. I think that's probably a lot of reason why I was had this body image thing and had embarrassment when I was in junior high and high school. But anyway, so that's that. So, you know, for my straight listeners, you can get off too. Get into your body. Get yourself a girl or a guy or whatever, whoever you are, and, you know, get down to the dirty. Just get into your body and become body-centered and, you know, whatever. Enjoy your orgasms.
And now let's meet our next team of challengers.
What is your name, please?
My name is Betsy Clark.
My name is Betsy Clark.
My name is Betsy Clark.
We'll learn Betsy Clark's story and play our next game in a minute. Very well, panel, open up your second envelope now, if you will, please. Follow along with me as I read from my copy. I, Betsy Clark, am spending a summer with my friend Willie.
Woot, woot, woot. Please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals. Voot, voot, voot.
We get along swimmingly, since Willie is a whale, one of the only two North Atlantic pilot whales in captivity. 5 times a day I climb on his back and he whirls me around through and under the waters of a huge tank. We get along particularly well since I am the one who feeds him his daily ration of fish. I am doing this to help pay my way through college, and needless to say, I'm having a whale of a summer. Signed, Betsy Clark. Kitty Carlisle.
This is so interesting, you don't want to stop me.
That's right.
Number two, it's absolutely fascinating. Is his back rough when you climb on?
No, it's not. It's like a wet inner tube to a tire.
Number three, what do you hang on to when you get on his back?
I hang on to his dorsal fin.
His what?
Dorsal fin.
His dorsal, is that rough?
No.
Number one, when he dives underneath the water, how far under does he go?
Just a couple of feet.
And he surfaces pretty soon, so that
yes.
you don't... Yes, I see. And number two, number one said that he became tame in captivity. How was he tamed?
Well, the professor and I worked together with the whale, and I got in the water with him, and
well, how did you reach his more sensitive side?
Just by, well, feeding him, for one.
Number three, does a whale eat plankton?
What is a certain type of whale?
What does Willie eat?
Willie eats squid.
What? Squid.
Squid. Tom Poston. Kitty.
Well, I would have voted for number one because she has the tan. She has short hair, which if you're under the water a great deal of the time would be convenient. But I voted for number two because I felt that she really did have a great deal of feeling for Willie. And all that year's training with the professor and all, I thought that was absolutely...
It's number one. I'll make you a side bet. Yeah.
Very well. We'll find out which one in truth is Betsy Clark in a minute. Let's see which one of these young ladies in truth rides on the back of a whale. Will the real Betsy Clark please stand up? Thank you very much. Betsy, where do you do this act?
I ride Willie at Aquarama.
Where?
Aquarama, 3300 South Broad Street, Philadelphia.
Kitty Carlisle is dead. I love Kitty Carlisle, and I'm not making a joke about that. I used to watch To Tell the Truth with my grandmother. Oh, those were the days. Anyway, Kitty Carlisle Hart, also billed as Kitty Carlisle, born September 3rd, 1910 in New Orleans, died April 17th, just recently in New York City, of pneumonia. She was an American singer, actress, spokeswoman for the arts. She is best known for having been a regular panelist on the television game show To Tell the Truth, and her frequent appearances on another game show, What's My Line. The entertainer was a tireless advocate for the arts, serving 20 years on the New York State Council of the Arts. In 1991, she received the National Medal of Arts from President George H.W. Bush. She died April 17, 2007, from pneumonia. She will be buried in a crypt next to her husband, Moss Hart, at Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale.
You've been listening to The Flatus Show.
Woot, woot, woot. Please go to theflatusshow.com, click on the links to the podcast, look at the show notes, and donate to Easter Seals. Woot, woot, woot.
You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.